Welcome to Awkwardish. My name is Ruby, and I'm a blogger, vlogger, and peer specialist who focuses on mental health, substance use, domestic violence, and a few other subjects. Thanks for joining us. Let's get started.
Hello. Welcome to the Awkwardish podcast. Today, we have a very special guest who is my best friend in the whole world. Her name is Ty, and she's also a therapist, which makes her very, very useful on the topics that we're going to discuss. Say hi, Ty.
Hi.
And today, we're going to talk about the problems with 12-step programs. Ty, can you tell the audience a little bit about how your work is relevant to this?
Like which part? All of it, really. But like my experience primarily lies from working at a residential substance use program for women. So that's kind of like where I got all my experience, pretty much.
Okay. And then just to clarify with the audience, Ty has never had substance use issues like I have. So we're going to dive right into into my bullet points that I put down. So one of my main issues with 12-step programs is that they utilize untrained, unskilled lay people as a substitute for therapy, and they call them sponsors. And that always bothered me especially because of the way that they talk about therapy. Have you witnessed any of the aversion to therapy that people who follow 12 steps have displayed?
That is like a huge thing. But you know, I can say that depending on the like population or the program, it could vary. And the reason why it could vary is because, you know, like the program I was at, we required all of our, you know, clients to obtain a therapist as well as a sponsor, because there are benefits to both. So when you're speaking to like kind of the 12-step model kind of being against therapy, I definitely have seen that, because we would get a lot of resistance when we would tell our clients sometimes, like, you know, like, hey, you got to get an outside therapist, and they would go, well, I got a sponsor, I don't need a therapist, I go to meetings, why do I need therapy? So we would kind of have to explain the benefits with respect to having a therapist and a sponsor, or just having a therapist, because there are benefits to both.
Yeah, I do agree that there can be benefits to both. I had a sponsor for a few years when I was still in NA, and she was great. She's a great person, but it's more the fact that the program tells you have to get this person and basically check in with them about every single decision that you make. And it's because it kind of teaches you, you tell them you can't trust your own mind, so you have to entrust your decisions into this other person who apparently can't trust their own mind because they have a sponsor too. And it goes on and on and on,
like a pyramid scheme.
Yes, exactly.
I'm sorry, I cut you off, go ahead.
No, it's okay, I actually forgot what I was gonna say.
We're talking about the everlasting list of sponsors and sponsor sisters and this whole community that is like has porous boundaries and a lot of rigidity. I definitely understand what you're saying when you're like, you know, 12 steps say you must get a sponsor and you must do all of these things. I think it could be beneficial if you have a more progressive sponsor. Like if, for example, like if you were to become a sponsor, like just because you're not practicing actively 12 steps, that doesn't mean you can't have sponsees. You know what I mean? Like, because I do feel that the benefit of having a sponsor is that it is someone that you could unapologetically be yourself with. And it's in a non-professional manner. So it's kind of like having a friend, if you will. I mean, I just said pour its boundaries, but I mean, essentially that's like the defining thing between a sponsor and a therapist. I mean, outside of the fact, like you said, they're not trained, they don't know anything, but they know what it is to live a life of addiction, whereas some therapists do not. Right? Like, mm-hmm. However, there are people who get their lives together and they go back to school and they become therapists. If you have a real boundaried therapist, they would never tell their client that they're in recovery. And that's the difference, like, that I think that could be beneficial, to be able to talk to someone and, like, the sponsor, and they say, you know what? Yeah, I had experiences like that happen with me, because I fall from on the line of no self-disclosure when it comes to what you share with your clients. Mm-hmm. So some therapists don't believe that. Like, they, you know, they self-disclose a lot or a little. Like, if I was in recovery, I would never tell my client that, ever. I would never disclose that. But a sponsor, they have to be in recovery. So when a client is going through something, the sponsor could easily be like, yeah, you know, something similar to that happened to me, and they could swap war stories. That would never happen in therapy. So I feel like that's the benefit. The downside is a lot of them believe that you just don't have control over the addiction. They don't honor or acknowledge the changes in your brain chemistry or just how mental health plays into. There's so many other things that goes along with addiction that some sponsors just don't buy into. They just feel like, you know, you don't have control, give yourself up to a higher power, they'll fix it. If you follow this, you'll be okay. That's not, in my experience, that's not true.
Unfortunately, that actually tends to be the majority of sponsors, but in my experience. And a lot of people take it to the extreme. They'll talk about, you know, you don't need to take meds. I've heard this more in AA, because I did AA at first. I've heard people say taking psych meds is chewing your booze. You know, it got to a point where people were afraid to even talk about psych medications in meetings. And this is something else that I encountered in my deprogramming group. I heard, like, horrible stories in there, but they're not my stories to tell. But in my experience, though, I've seen a lot of people discouraged from taking meds. And that, to me, was a huge red flag. I don't know how I stayed for 2 years after that.
Yeah, and I mean, in NA, it's worse.
Oh, yeah.
And the culture of all of that, like, of the 12-step model is very oppressive in a way, because, like you said, there's a lot of shame and, you know, guilt associated with, I mean, like, in some NA groups, from what I've seen with women, they will tell them, like, you're not sober. Like, oh, okay, so we all know that using certain substances ruin your teeth, right? Like, mm-hmm. And I've seen women have to get massive amounts of dental work done. Their NA sponsor will say, well, you got to get that tooth pulled, but you know you can't take the pain medication. And it's like, but wait, what? They're about to pull out half of my teeth. What do you mean? You know, so it's exactly what you're saying. Like, they're, you know, shaming them, you know, calling them out, telling them they're no longer sober, but medically you need medication or you're going to be suffering. But it's like, oh no, because you had addiction or you had a problem, you can't take those pills because that's a drug. And it's like, no.
And that is actually a root problem that I have with the program, because that's one of the core elements is one is too many and a thousand is never enough. They teach you that once you have it in your body, you no longer have control. If you just have one, you're going to spiral and you're going to end up in jail, an institution, or dying. And that's just bizarre.
It sounds a lot like brainwashing to me.
It is, especially when they do the 90 meetings in 90 days when you first start. and they're telling you to do multiple meetings in a day. And mm-hmm. so you're being programmed for 90 days. Mm-hmm. And you ask a question, they're going to shout you down. You offer a criticism, that's not acceptable.
Yep.
So you have to fall in line. And then they teach you that they are the only way. They're the last house on the block, the end of the road. Like, it's insane because there are so many other programs. And I knew that when I went in. I had actually done research before I was court ordered to go to NA or AA. I did both at first. But before I was court ordered, I was doing research on alternatives. So I knew that there were other ways. But when you go in there, they deny the existence of those other programs. And even when one or two people acknowledge that they exist, they say, oh, those don't work, without knowing a thing about them.
Yeah, and that is very problematic for a multitude of reasons. I mean, obviously, we're not all, you know, cookie cutters fitting into one box. Everybody's journey is different. Everybody's experience is different. And everybody's biological chemistry is different. And for, you know, them to just say like, oh, no, those other programs isn't going to work. It's like, well, but why? I mean, is there, when they say they don't work, do they then follow up with why they feel this model is superior to others? Or are they just saying it's not going to work because we said so and this is the right way? You know, it's like you have to kind of back up what you're saying. And I mean, you know, quite frankly, you know, for me, as, you know, someone that is heavy steeped into mental health, it is like, where is your science behind this? Because I feel like for AA to have been around for, I mean, almost 100 years, they haven't evolved much.
Not at all.
I mean, it is the same program that it's been. So it's like, where's the evolution? Where's the growth? And that I have a problem with that, because it's like times have changed, things have changed. There have been different advancements, but this model has not advanced.
Exactly. We're using an 80-year-old program that was developed by a defunct salesman and a colorectal surgeon. Bill W. He came up with AA, and when he was, I think he was high on shrooms or acid or something. But he, and then he borrowed from another program that existed before that. I can't remember the name of it at the moment. But it's a cult. I'm sorry, I just gotta say it. I spent 3 years in NA. You know, the first 6 months I was in NA, I was doing NA and AA. But I spent 3 years in NA, and I just, now that I've deprogrammed, it's like, oh my God. Like the fear tactics, you know, the oh gosh.
I mean, they don't,
oh, go ahead.
Go ahead. You first. I can hold my thought.
Okay. I was going to say, and then there's the fact that they don't actually teach you how to deal with anything or how to cope with your emotions. Everything is a slogan or, you know, thought stopping, but you never actually learn how to deal with those emotions like you would do in therapy. You don't learn coping skills. They call it coping skills, but really you're just doing the steps, which are, I mean, it's just a false religion, basically. And it's, if I hadn't been in therapy the whole time, I would still be in the same place I was 3 years ago, four years ago.
Yeah. And I think part of that is because a lot of the teachings, like you talked about, like doing the step work, right, is like they're trying to make you believe that you are powerless, which I have, I mean, like as a woman, as a Black woman, I mean, I have so many issues with teaching people to assume that they are powerless. Yeah. Like as if we have no agency over ourselves. We are not capable of, you know, making decisions or, you know, making change or whatever. Like, that is like a huge problem because, you know, while there are some things we cannot control, such as mental illness, right? We can't control if we, you know, suffer from those challenges. However, we are capable of making decisions. And I think that we are capable of critical thinking and problem solving and really exploring different avenues. And I feel like 12-step kind of puts it on something, but it's not the individual. What about accountability? What about, you know, really recognizing that something is going on and you really need to address it? It's like, oh no, you know, like this, the power, I need to just abstain. And if I'm not abstaining, something in me is broken. And that just, yeah, I mean, that speaks to the cult, right? Like you're powerless, you have no control. You don't know, you can't think, you need to rely on this model or else you're lost to the world. I hate it.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, you know, I would, I mean, you know what I'm saying? Like, I recognize that, like, in my position, I'm definitely going to have, you know, people come to me for therapy that are suffering with addiction. And I'm going to have to honor wherever they are in that journey, right? So I'm going to have hardcore, you know, 12-steppers sitting across from me, and I'm going to have to hold that space, you know. But I do recognize that it is my role to help people, you know, see them, their whole self, right? Like, and it's okay. Like, even if they're hardcore, it's like, I'm not here to say it's good or bad. I'm here to help you take a look at your life and gain some understanding for where you are in that place and time, like in your life. And so I think that like when you get those hardcore people, and 9 times out of 10 if they're in therapy and they're doing 12-step, it's probably court ordered. So really recognizing that resistance and like really trying to work with that and help people really understand, you know, how the mind and the body works and how mental health intersects with addiction. And the question is, what came first, addiction or substance use or mental health? That is like this whole thing that has yet to be understood. I believe that mental health comes first, but who knows?
Yeah, I believe mental health comes first too, or some type of trauma usually precedes drug use, you know, or alcohol use. So, yeah, and I think getting down to the core of it is the only way you're going to overcome a substance use disorder. That's another thing. Calling addiction, quote unquote, a disease is so incorrect because a disease, it's a disorder, and a disease and a disorder are not the same thing. I actually looked up the difference between a disease and a disorder. I'm sorry, I keep stuttering. A disease is an abnormal condition affecting the body of an organism, and a disorder is a functional abnormality, you know? So it's like, they're not the same thing. And calling it a disease it's another way of shaming people. Like, you're diseased, and then you have all these character defects you have to work on. If it's a disease, what do my character defects have to do with it?
Mm-hmm.
This is like so bizarre.
But that speaks to the lack of progression within this model. I understand in 1932, for whatever year this came about, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I understand then not really having the language to, or even just a full understanding of, you know, what it means to be hooked on something, right? So you call it addiction, and how are you going to describe it? Okay, they're describing it as a disease in order to launch a product or get people, I mean, you know, like it's supposed to be nonprofit and all this stuff, whatever. But, you know, like you're marketing something. So it's like, okay, you got to figure out what it is, because if you don't really know at that time, like you got to come up with something. But I feel like that's part of the limitations is like, where is the progression? Like over time we have learned it is not a disease. It's not, like, it is a disorder and it needs to be viewed in that way. But 12-step does not. Like, I mean, it's insane to hear people like really just recite all of these quotes and all of this stuff from the big book when you try to talk about viewing it as a disorder versus an individual being like having a diseased mind, you know, and all these things wrong with them. It is really challenging to hear people say those things and disagree with it being a disorder. And that just lets me know that they're uneducated and on the topic, even though it is something that they suffer from, and they refuse to open their minds to any other thing. And it makes me wonder if they're refusing to be open to something else, because if they do, that means that they're human and they're susceptible to relapse. Because people who feel like they're strong in their recovery, they feel like nothing could take them out. So if they acknowledge that, you know what, it is a possibility that that could happen based upon this other stuff, that makes them vulnerable. And I feel that some people just don't want to acknowledge that because that puts their quote unquote sobriety in jeopardy. Because we know 12-step is hardcore abstinence, when in reality, that's unrealistic.
Yeah, I actually hadn't thought of that. That's a really good point, because I was thinking it just, you know, it would shatter their worldview. So they refuse to accept it because they realize they've been living a lie, or they didn't need to be this rigid and living this lifestyle for however long they've been. But yeah, you have a point. You know, people can fall into either of those categories.
What you just said is true. That's like an expansion of like essentially what I'm saying. Like, the whole world will be shattered. I mean, whether or not they might feel like they're living a lie, but like ultimately that means that to accept these other alternatives is to accept that I am susceptible to relapse also, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I, you know what I mean? Like, yeah, like everything would be shattered. It's like, oh my God, like everything I thought was true is not. But with that comes, one must accept, oh, it really could happen to me, no matter how strong I believe in this, no matter how hard I'm thumping and pushing this message, it could happen to me too.
Yep. And you know what? And then also that fear comes from the way that they make it seem like it would be the end of the world to relapse, because they tell you that, again, one is too many and 1,000 is never enough. Once you start, you won't be able to stop. So people are terrified of relapse because they think they're going to end up, you know, in a jail institution or dead. I used to avoid walking down the liquor aisle, not go into liquor stores, you know, avoid certain neighborhoods. It was insane. I felt like that little bit of temptation would ruin my life to walk down the wine aisle or Bailey's. Mm-hmm. And it's like, you shouldn't have to live in fear. You know, they don't go to parties where they have alcohol. Don't be around your family if they're smoking weed, you know. So basically all my time was spent with other 12-step people, going to dances and things like that, which were fun, but I couldn't spend as much time with my family as I preferred to. And that was just
problematic.
Yes, and it was sad. Like, oh my gosh, I'm sad for who I was a couple of years ago.
And I have two thoughts. One is too many, 1,000 is never enough, semicolon, however, comma, you have some mental health challenges that need to be addressed. That is why the previous statement is to be true. Because I do believe for some people that statement is true, mm-hmm. but it's true because they are not dealing with the shit that led them. Oh, am I supposed to be like PG?
No, yeah, you can go.
They're not dealing with what they need to deal with to address why they started using in the first place. I mean, like, to hear women talk about, I smoked meth at 12, you did what? Listen, I had my whole world broke wide open, okay? Like, we didn't grow up on no hill with no fences. We grew up in the ghetto, in the hood. Mm-hmm. We've seen it all. Shootings, yep. Drugs, people in the family. Like, we've been exposed to it all. But I mean, we didn't see our family members when they was kids because we wasn't born. They was all adults. And I'm not gonna lie, when we was coming up, if anybody our age was getting high when we were in middle school, I damn sure didn't know about it. Like it wasn't evident. Like we didn't see a lot of homeless youth. Like we didn't see these things. Now, if it was happening, it was definitely happening behind somebody closed doors, what happened in our house, stay in our house type of situation, I guess. But we didn't see those kinds of things. But to be working with these women and they're saying, oh, I started using when I was 12. I drank my first sip of liquor when I was 8. It's like, what? Oh, I used to break into the wine cabinet at 9. Oh, I would, you know, steal my mama's cigarette butts, things like that. Or I would pick up whatever they were doing. I was sneaking this and that. I was getting high. I started shooting mainline heroin at 16. It's like, wait, what? It took so long for me to wrap my head around young people using hard drugs. I just couldn't understand it. Right. But then as I got to know these women, I would come to find out mom or dad was probably on drugs. One was missing. Abuse, rape. I mean, I've heard horrible, terrible stories of child neglect or abuse at the hands of their parents and others. Right. It's like, oh, now it makes sense why you were drinking all the liquor and filling the bottles up with water. Because that was what was in the house that you had access to, because you knew when your dad came home, he was gonna attack everybody in the family. So you just wanted to numb out, you know? So it, you know, it's hard to really understand like how someone so young could start using substances, but you have to recognize that something's happening that causes that to happen. And when people aren't addressing those things and kind of working through those things, yeah, if you take one drink, it wrecks your whole life all over again. And yeah, you feel like, you know, 12-step has brainwashed these people to think that, oh, you complete all the steps, you work so hard, you know, you're on the road. But really, as you said earlier, they're not teaching you the tools. They're not teaching you how to cope. They're just saying, stay away from those people, avoid those people. And what did you say in the beginning? It's like some sort of religion. As I'm saying these things, all I can keep thinking is like, oh, it's the devil. Like, you got to stay away from that temptation. Don't be around them. They no good for you. They're a bad influence. And I do feel that, you know, we can stay away from some people because toxicity is real. And some people are bad for our mental health. Period. Like, they can send you on a spiral no matter who or what or where you are in your life. Like, there are some people you just have to cut off, family included. Mm-hmm. One thing we would do was relapse prevention planning with our women. And it was interesting because you definitely have to identify triggers. You have to identify like personal triggers, people, places, things, you know, that's what they love to say, right? Mm-hmm. And what made the work challenging is because 90% of our clients were homeless. And if they weren't homeless, they had housing. Where? Right in the center, the epicenter of all the drug trafficking and all of this stuff, right? So it's like, we had to then work to teach these women how to go back and integrate. Even though 12-step is saying you need to stay away from all these places. Well, is 12-step gonna get you a house on the hill away from all drugs? Because, exactly. It's like, because you gotta go live back over there, or you don't even have nowhere to live. So we gotta figure that out too. But it's like, but they're telling you, oh, you can't be around all these people. Don't go, you know, like you said, don't go on that street. Where's the areas you used to use? Well, you can't go over there no more. But if that's where you live, what's the other alternatives? Exactly. You gotta work to build up that. I don't know what we're building, but we're building something, some resilience, something for them to be able to go back into those settings and know that, like, you know, I am strong. If my goal is to abstain, if that is that individual's goal, I'm getting the tools to be able to do that. If my goal is to use less, well, I'm gonna work on being able to use less. I mean, I'm not from an abstinence mindset. I don't think it's realistic. So I don't believe in it.
That was a huge problem for me too. I still remember when I first went into NA and they were like, you can never have anything, any mind altering substance again, including weed. And I'm like, including weed? So, yeah, I really couldn't wrap my head around that, but I stuck to the program for a couple of years, and then finally I got a medical marijuana recommendation, and I was like, you know what, this is just how it's going to be, because my anxiety was really getting to me, and then I couldn't sleep. Like, I couldn't sleep for like 2 weeks, and I knew what would get me to sleep. So I did that, and I told only my sponsor at first, and she was like, oh, okay, whatever helps you sleep. But I was going to these in times of illness meetings, which is the meetings where people can talk about the medications they take and feel safe. And one day, right before I was going to talk about how the medical marijuana had helped me sleep and all that, the lady before me, who I had previously had a whole lot of respect for, she goes on talking about how someone she knows uses marijuana and how she laughs at the fact that they think they're still clean. And I was just like, yeah, I can't do this anymore.
And can we talk about terminology real quick? Like, mm-hmm. Clean, dirty. I don't like it.
I don't either.
When we're talking about language and framing, it's like, oh, good and bad. It's like, no, you're not clean because you didn't use, and you're not dirty because you did. And I mean, like, that's all the mind. I mean, like, it's a mind fuck, because it's mm-hmm. like, oh, I don't want to be dirty, so I'm just going to stay away from it, you know? And it's like, no, like, that's wrong on a lot of levels, because it is not helping people stay sober if that's their goal, for the right reasons.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. And then having to label yourself as an alcoholic or an addict, that's just, oh my gosh. Like, labels are for jars, not people.
That's a good one.
Yeah, I actually got that from my Smart Recovery, which is my favorite. My favorite recovery program, and they actually, I think they don't even consider themselves to be a recovery program, but they help people get over addictions, not just to substances, but like behaviors like gambling and sex addiction and things like that. And it's all CBT and DBT based. Perfect. Or no, actually it's CBT and REBT. So yeah.
I'm a little familiar with Smart Recovery. Pre-COVID, there was a couple. I mean, obviously very limited because it's not as popular, so they don't have the resources to just be everywhere, mm-hmm. like AA and NA and anything that's under the 12-step umbrella. But we had a couple of, you know, clients that did Smart Recovery or Life Ring, and some of the other, you know, like non-traditional like modalities. But it's really hard, I think, for people struggling, because what you hear is that 12-step model. That's everywhere. Like, everybody talks about it. Everybody automatically assumes, even though programs, like recovery programs, a lot of them, if they're taking money from like the state or like the government, they're supposed to be like non-denominational and not really subscribing to one thing or the other, because it's supposed to be like integrated and inclusive. But a lot of the philosophies, because like even in the program where I worked, like we didn't discharge for relapse, but it was a whole lot of shit that went along with a relapse. Like, if you came back to our facility and you were high, like we literally wouldn't let you in. We would come to the door, UA you at the door. If you was positive, we would kind of try to evaluate if you were safe to enter the community, but most of the time we would send their ass to detox. They could come back after they went to detox, or if we let them in, because like say they came back at like 10 or 11 at night and it was hella late, they had to stay in their room. They couldn't come out and be in the community. So there was a punitive measure to using, even though we claimed to be harm reduction and all this bullshit, right? Like, but if people use, there were consequences. Like you would have to, yeah, I'm gonna call them consequences. You would have to meet with the recovery therapist to talk about how, why, what happened, create a safety plan on how this is never gonna happen again, what you're gonna do differently. It's like the fact that this woman came back, to me, that's harm reduction. Like, yeah, they used, we all under, but then we would say shit like, relapse is part of recovery. It is. So like we were, like we had a good program, but there were a lot of mixed messages. It's like how on one hand you can say, oh, we're trauma-informed, harm reduction, we meet people where they're at, blah, blah, blah. But if somebody relapsed, you damn near not about to let them in. Because, and being as though what my role was, I understand why. It is a trigger to the community to have someone visibly under the influence.
Yeah.
Like, I completely understand that. But it's like, then we got to work on what we're saying overall. Because if we're saying, you know, relapse is part of the, you know, part of the process, we're not going to discharge you for relapse, but yet we come meet you at the front door and you better pee on this cup. If you don't pee, you can't come in at all. You need to blow into this breathalyzer. You blow numbers, whatever, like we sending you to detox. To me, that feels punitive.
In a way it does, but it's better than what the rehab I went to did, because
they,
if someone
they kicked you out
right then and in front of everyone. So, and there were people who would be crying and screaming, you know, don't kick me out, whatever. And they're like packing their bags for them if they wouldn't pack their bag. It was crazy.
Oh yeah, so. That's, oh hell no, that couldn't have been my staff. Like, we're not doing that, because we also have to be compassionate. These are humans. And also why we weren't so quick to discharge people is because we also recognize that, like I said, 99.9% was homeless. Where are they going?
Right
back to the shelter, back to the shelter where they got raped at 2 months ago, that they was just telling you, like, come on, you know, back out on these streets where all types of horrible things have happened to them. So like we definitely came from a more compassionate lens, but I just feel like some of the messaging surrounding like relapse is confusing and contradictory.
Because
if it's, you know, it's like, you know, it's like if we saying, yes, it absolutely, because we have big books and all, you know, we gave our materials to them. We required a sponsor. They had to be doing step work. Like, and that was all part of their goals. Like, you're meeting with your sponsor and you're working on the steps. And it's like, why the hell are we pushing that? Because we know 12 steps is an abstinence-based model, but yet we're saying we're harm reduction and we're preaching, you know, we're trying to, reduce the stigma around relapse, and we're saying like it's part of the process. Like, don't worry, it's not the end of the world if you use. It is not the end of the world if you feel like using. If you thinking about using, that does not mean that something's wrong with you, you know. But yet we're telling them get a sponsor and work the steps. It's like, what? It's crazy.
That leaves and no they, room and for they any were, other option.
Initially, they were required to go to AA or NA meetings. Like, that's what our paperwork said. And then I was like, there are other stuff. So can we just say recovery-based support groups? Because, you know, it's like, can we change? Because I think, you know, I think that's the blessing and the curse about the written and spoken word. Like, words have so much power, and the English language is a clusterfuck because we have so many words that mean so many things, but we also have a lot of words that have negative connotations associated with them. And when people, like you said, upon themselves, they roll with it. So it's like, we can't just be saying, oh, you need to go to NAAA meetings, because if that is to be true, like, what messages are they learning in those meetings? They're going to hear people get up and speak and talk about all these things we're saying we don't represent. To me, that doesn't work. Like, no. I don't, they don't go together. And then we're saying, go get a therapist. That's probably going to be preaching what we're preaching, which is relapse is part of the process. Like, we need to kind of figure out and uncover some of this trauma. Let's unpack this. Let's work through this. Let's help you help yourself, right? Mm-hmm. It's crazy making.
No. Guys, I totally forgot what I was going to say now.
I'm sorry, I was on the rant.
That's okay. Oh, yeah, so I was going to talk about the alternative programs now. Of course, there's good old CBT, Cognitive Behavioral Therapy, which I highly recommend, or DBT, or REBT, or just get a therapist. There's also Smart Recovery, which you can find at smartrecovery.org. The Freedom Model at thefreedommodel.org. There's the Sinclair Method. I could not find a site for that, but the Sinclair Method you can find a lot of information on by Googling. And then there's HAMS, or Harm Reduction for Alcohol, which is at HAMS, HAMS.cc. So,
we talked a lot about harm reduction. What's harm reduction?
Isn't harm reduction where you try to control the amount that you drink or use?
Yeah, so I mean, by definition, the purpose of harm reduction is to reduce the occurrence of harm to self or others. And in practice, what that looks like is staying safe. So if you was drinking 2 bottles of wine a day, if you only drink 1, that is harm reduction. Like, that is just the easiest example there is, right? Or if you was mainlining heroin and you decided to smoke it instead, I don't even know if that's a thing. That's harm reduction. So practices that are being, and steps being taken to reduce harm. So nowhere in there does it say you cannot use. If that's the individual's goal, I'm here for it. I'm gonna support you in doing that. But if that's not your goal, let's work on how to keep you safe so you can stay alive, right? Like, I mean, ultimately, that's, you know, what we want is for people to live their best lives, if you will. And that doesn't mean that one might be substance free. They just need to be safe.
Exactly. It does not mean they have to be a part of a program that only has a 5-8% success rate, which is what that's 12-step program success rate. 5-8%.
Isn't that insane? And yet, people scared to get the COVID vaccine, but they go to a AA meeting and sign up for this program. Like, what?
And think it's going to keep them clean or sober. I'm sorry, I used that word again, but they think it'll keep them abstinent.
Yeah, it's ridiculous. I'm sorry, I'm not signing up for nothing with a 10% effective rate. Like, this your success rate? Like, less than 10%. Like, that's insane. And then no one's trying to figure out why.
No,
because why.
They blame people. They blame the person who relapsed for their relapse. That's why they don't ask why. People weren't working a strong enough program. They weren't being honest enough. You know, they needed to do another 4th step or a 10th step or whatever. It's always, if it doesn't work for someone, it's their fault. It's not the program.
So what does it mean to be working a strong program? Like, what does that look like with just doing the steps?
Doing the steps, going to meetings, doing like volunteer work at recovery, at NA related things. It can't be like in your community, that doesn't count apparently. Like giving back to the program, leading meetings or holding a position with the I forgot what it's called.
Oh, like at the meeting, like,
yeah, at the meetings, over the meetings. I can't remember what they're called. It's been over a year.
Like a commitment.
Yeah, having a commitment, having a service commitment. That's what it's called. Oh, gosh.
I know. You have me digging in my archive. I'm like, wait a minute, because we used to have people that do it. What is it called? Yes, a commitment.
Yes. So, yeah, having service commitments, going to a lot of meetings, doing all your step work, talking to your sponsor every day, reaching out to other people in the program, only associating with people in recovery. That's all considered having a strong program.
Yeah, sounds like bullshit to me. And I will say this, that like I do think that the steps could potentially work if you coupled it with really doing the rest of the work. Like, what's the point in doing all these self-inventories and making amends and all of this shit if you're not really honing in on some of your internal shit that's going on that even caused you to do it, right? Like, so I said to one of my homegirls, like, yesterday, like, she was like, my son lied, he a liar, I put him out, like, he's a liar, blah, blah, blah. And I was like, well, reframe. Like, instead of focusing on the action, let's focus on the impact. I was like, so when you have a conversation with him, instead of spending 20 minutes calling him a liar, why don't you talk about you and how you were impacted by the lie?
Yes.
And I think that, like, that's the next step. And that's why therapy works for people and for people in general. But that's why it works, because it turns the lens on self. And you can identify an action, and then you need to talk about what, how this landed, like the impact your actions is having on others, and let that be the focus instead of just labeling you as something bad or whatever. Yeah. Like, it's like, let's talk about, like, when I'm using, what is the emotional, financial, interpersonal wreckage that I'm causing, because it's like a wrecking ball. Like, when people go on, like, whatever it is, you weeks and months at a time not seeing your kids, not seeing your family, you stealing, you doing whatever to feed this addiction, because you're self-medicating because you don't want to deal with the hurt, the whatever, the trauma that happened to you.
Man, yeah, that's a really good, I'm sorry, I was, as you were talking, I was like, huh, but yeah, we're actually coming up on almost an hour, we're at like 47 minutes, I think we should probably wrap up.
Well, let's wrap it up.
All right, and so I'd like to thank you all for listening, and there will be an accompanying blog post with this, providing those links that I mentioned. And yeah, thanks for listening. And this, again, this has been the Awkwardest Podcast. Say bye, Ty.
Bye.